from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. Coming up later today, we're going to be covering the race in the 91st Assembly District. The incumbent is Republican Treg Pryczynski. The Democratic candidate is Maria Bamonte, and we'll talk about that race coming up. But first, coming up on Monday on the campus of UW-La Crosse, an important distinction is being added to our campus, in which the Fine Arts Center is being renamed in honor of the late artist Truman Lowe. And we're joined today by someone who knew and worked with Truman Lowe and has published about Truman Lowe. She is the Nystrom Professor Emerita of Art History at Beloit College and author of the book Woodland Reflections, The Art of Truman Lowe. Welcome to Newsmakers, Joe Ortel. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So this this building, the Fine Arts Center, is being renamed the Truman T. Lowe Center for the Arts at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. How does that make you think? When you think back on your professional association, personal association with Truman Lowe, how does that make you feel?
Oh, it's just wonderful. It was all, I believe, it was Chancellor Gao's primary. His impetus that created this interest. Truman graduated from UW-La Crosse in 1969, and he was an art education major, and he really always talked about La Crosse very fondly and felt that was really a transformational time in his life. So that having the building renamed in his honor is just... it's exquisite. It's wonderful. And he would be smiling for sure if he, wherever he is, I guess.
And Truman Lowe is, he passed away a couple of years ago, but he was Ho-Chunk. And that was an extremely important part, obviously, of his life, but also his work, his art, his output. Then, as you said, attended UW-La Crosse as a student. Talk about Truman Lowe as an artist for people who might not be familiar with his work.
Sure. He was a sculptor and an installation artist in a sort of avant-garde modernist kind of vein. And he worked primarily with wood, both natural sticks and branches, and then also lumber. So he was making sculpture and installations that were about both his Native American, his Ho-Chunk heritage, and also the natural environment of the upper Midwest. He really considered himself a woodland Indian. He grew up in the Ho-Chunk community outside of Black River Falls, and he was surrounded during his childhood and youth by the traditional arts and crafts that the Ho-Chunk made for the tourist trade at that time. So he was surrounded by crafts and arts and using one's hands. And he was also fascinated with drawing. So his public school teachers even gave him the opportunity to use their classrooms when he was on study halls. So that gives you a sense that he was always kind of drawing, but it wasn't until, I mean, he didn't go to UW-La Crosse with the idea or the intention of becoming an artist. He really kind of floundered, if I can say that, for several years and tried out different art or different majors before he settled on art education. And once he became an art education major, he experimented with all kinds of mediums, printmaking, sculpture, ceramics. He did all sorts of things, and he really sort of thrived in that environment. I'm trying to think what else here.
Well, I'm wondering. You said that he was involved, and I've read elsewhere that his parents were involved in making handcrafts, you know, for sale for tourists and things like that, he was a very, very deep and serious artist that we all have come to know. And, you know, touristy stuff. I mean, you make stuff for tourists because it's what they'll buy, not because it's what speaks to you as an artist. How did that process of making those things for the tourist trade influence his art? Like, did he go the direction he did artistically to kind of get away from that? Or was there still an element of that incorporated in his work later?
Well, that's an excellent question, because he really, while he was at UW-La Crosse, he really sort of was experimenting with all sorts of Western Eurocentric kinds of avant-garde art styles. And he sort of left his Ho-Chunk crafts and arts behind for a while. But then gradually, as he found himself, as he matured as an artist, he, after graduate school and after teaching a few years, he realized that he really, as I said, was a woodland Indian. And he started drawing on his images and the history that he was taught as a child and at the Indian mission outside of Black River Falls. So it wasn't so much that he rejected the arts and crafts. In fact, he really was a champion of all arts and crafts of Native Americans. Even though his work was really in a kind of modernist Western fine art vein, he was always very happy to see traditional arts and crafts by Native Americans as well.
You talked about his art being in a more of a Western vein, and that reminded me about in a lot of disciplines, not just art, but in academia, there is this Eurocentricity in a lot of the art that is sort of academically approved or that is considered high art, whether it's in visual art or in theater or in music or in a lot of these things. Did he have to kind of defend his own artistic voice as he tried to bring more of his heritage into it?
I don't think as he brought it into his work, no. That's another really interesting question. It was always, and I've been working on my remarks for Monday's ceremony, and I'm having trouble, you know, talking about what's the difference between arts and crafts and fine arts, what he did, and those traditional Ho-Chunk arts and crafts like basketry and beadwork and that sort of thing. He kind of saw the two as being on a continuum. He wasn't concerned about categories, except that he did understand that we human beings, and art historians especially, I have to say, that we really like categories. We like to put things in boxes, as he said. And so he was always interested in kind of expanding popular conceptions of what contemporary Native American art looked like, what it could encompass, so that he drew upon those Native arts and crafts that he grew up with and other tribes' arts and crafts as well. But then he also was interested in contemporary art, in non-Native influences as well. So he kind of melded or intertwined the two in his artwork.
Now, I'm curious about your knowledge of him and awareness of his work. When did you first become acquainted with Truman Lowe's work?
Oh, gosh, that was about 23 or 24 years ago. I was teaching in the art department at UW-Madison, and I was teaching a modern and contemporary art history class for them. And it was the end of a spring semester and I was exhausted and I didn't want to give any more lectures or, you know, prepare any more talks. And so I invited artists from the art department to come and give talks about their own art. And Truman was one of the few who graciously agreed to come and talk to my class about his own artwork. And that was my first introduction, really. And I was just mesmerized both by the artwork, the imagery, the sculptural forms, and then also the way he spoke about his art. He was really thoughtful, and he sort of gave his artwork a number of layers. So there were a number of ways you could enter into it, if you will. And that was the beginning of our friendship. And it was shortly after that that I decided I wanted to write about him. And I thought I could write a book about him in a year or two. And he always used to tease me about that, because it actually took 10 years for me to fully understand both Wisconsin art, Ho-Chunk art, Native American art, and his own influences as well.
Well, when you were... Your book is called Woodland Reflections, The Art of Truman Low. You talked about how long it took you to write it. When you start actually putting pen to paper and deciding, you know, how much to describe of him as an American artist, and as a Native American artist, and as a Wisconsin artist, and how do you see all of those intersectionalities melding together to create him?
Oh gosh, it's not easy, and that's one of the challenges for me, I think. He really, you know, he moved very fluidly between his Ho-Chunk heritage and his background, and then the university setting and his academic career. And then later he worked as a curator of contemporary Native American art at the Smithsonian's new National Museum of the American Indian. And he always sort of moved fluidly through all of those. So the challenge for me really was, how do I talk about all the influences of his work, and let them all sort of speak without kind of narrowing him down or pigeonholing him, really.
You can find any number of videos, short and long clips of Truman Low talking about his work online, and I have. And it's interesting because he doesn't strike one as being unconfident in himself, but he really is quite soft spoken and unassuming in the way that he describes himself and his art. What was that like to try to get him to open up in a way that you could actually then turn into a written work about his output?
Well, that's really interesting, because I remember the first time he invited me out to see his studio where he was working out in Middleton. I didn't really prepare that many questions. I just thought, okay, I'll see what bubbles up. And he was very, not reluctant, but he was very short on words. He didn't give me a lot. And I think he was sort of testing me. He wasn't sure that he could trust me, really. So it was, at the beginning, it was kind of a challenge. But then as we got to know each other, I sort of fully understood his ideas, and he did open up much more as we got to know each other.
You talked about him incorporating different kinds of wood, both lumber and like found like sticks and different things in his work. Did he always work in those media primarily?
Well, that too is fascinating, because when he was at La Crosse, he was working in ceramics. He showed a bunch of ceramic eggs that were very brightly painted that looked kind of like pop art, or, you know, they were kind of funny. And then when he was in graduate school at UW-Madison in the early 1970s, he was working with sheets of plastic, literally sheets of plastic. And of course, this was the early 1970s, and plastic was the latest, hottest medium material for artists, modern artists, to be experimenting with. And it was only later, after he did a stint teaching in Kansas at Emporia State College, that he kind of returned to the natural materials of the Ho-Chunk, and particularly of his parents. His father made these exquisite wooden basket handles, and his mother made these splint plat baskets that were just exquisite. So he sort of returned to those roots as he matured as an artist.
How was that that stint in Kansas that you mentioned? He seems to have kind of realized a lot about who he was by moving away from who he was for that period of time.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. He really, he was, I wouldn't say he was distressed about being on the plains in Kansas, but he realized, he said, he often said he discovered he was a woodland Indian, and he liked being surrounded by the bluffs and the rivers and freshwater streams of Wisconsin, of the upper Midwest. So that really was kind of a realization that he came to as he was, while he was down there. They were only down there, I think, for 1 year. He was teaching down there, but he realized that he needed to come home. So
it sort of cemented his identity within himself in a way.
Absolutely, yeah. And to go back to your earlier question, when you were talking about that he was very unassuming, he was. He had a great sense of humor, kind of a goofy sense of humor. But one thing that was particularly enticing to me working with him was he didn't take himself too seriously. In other words, he was always challenging himself. He was very serious about his art and he'd been very thoughtful about his art, but he also loved to play. So he really he did have a strong sense of himself without being arrogant or egotistical. He was quite the opposite, I have to say.
Jo Ortel is with us today. She's the Nystrom Professor Emerita of Art History at Beloit College and the author of the book Woodland Reflections, The Art of Truman Lowe. And of course, we're talking about Truman Lowe because on Monday, the Fine Arts Center at UW-La Crosse is being dedicated in honor of Truman Lowe. It'll become the Truman T. Lowe Center for the Arts. At UW-La Crosse. We're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Jo Ortel in just a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest Wisconsin studio. Thank you very much for joining us today. Later on the program, our conversation about the 91st Assembly race. It is political season, and we certainly haven't forgotten that. We're going to be covering that race in a few moments. Now we return to our conversation with Jo Ortel, the Nystrom Professor Emerita of Art History at Beloit College. We're talking about Truman Lowe today and what made him tick as an artist, as a Wisconsin artist, as a Native American artist. And I want to talk about Truman Lowe because most of his career he was a teacher. He studied art education. He was a professor at UW-Madison from where he retired. Talk about Truman Lowe as a teacher and what role he played in the artistic lives and development of his students.
Well, as you can imagine, he taught, I think it was 35 years at UW-Madison. So he touched a number of students at UW and he really mentored a number of students. I think what students say about him the most is that they felt that he gave them freedom to find themselves. So in other words, students would come up with an idea and he would help them figure out how to realize that idea without kind of saying, now you have to make, you know, a horse out of clay or something like that. He was very much about helping, guiding, but with a very subtle hand, his students. So it was kind of a light touch as a teacher with artists or student underrepresented students, and particularly Native American students. He was a very active advocate and champion of recruiting Native students to UW-Madison, other underrepresented art or students to UW-Madison. He was really very committed, and that was largely, I think, because his family, as he was growing up, he was told by his much older sisters and brothers that he was the one who was going to be going to college to UW-La Crosse. And he had a number of mentors while he was at UW-La Crosse who really sort of helped him along and really gave him great support. So he always, as I said earlier, he always saw that as something that was very important, particularly for Native American students. Once you're thrown into a big university setting, it can be overwhelming. But he, particularly at UW-Madison, as a professor, he really helped to create a supportive, nurturing environment for Native American students, which was pretty spectacular. Education was his passion, and particularly education for underrepresented students.
Not only was a teacher for so many years, but he also was an active curator of exhibits. He took some time away from his teaching, in fact, to be very involved in that with the Smithsonian. I'm wondering, as he had opportunities to curate exhibits of his contemporaries, of other Native American artists, how did he tackle that endeavor?
Well, that's fascinating too. He was at the Smithsonian for several years before the National Museum of the American Indian opened in 2004, and then he was there for about 4 years after it opened as well. And he was invited to assume that position as curator of contemporary art there, and he really saw it as an opportunity where he could introduce, you know, the hundreds of thousands of museum goers who go to the mall in Washington, D.C., go to the Smithsonian. He really felt like he could introduce all those visitors to a broadened kind of conception of what contemporary Native American art could look like. So instead of just being portraits of stoic Indians or being an Indian on horseback, that kind of thing, or the traditional Native arts and crafts, he wanted general museum visitors to see the broad expanse, the possibilities of contemporary Native American creativity. And he went with gusto to that. He had a number of artists that he was interested in exhibiting before he got there, artists from the 20th and 21st century. And he put together some really powerful exhibits of people like Fritz Scholder and George Morrison, Alan Hauser, and then contemporaries, his own generation of artists like Kay Walking Stick and Jean Quick to See Smith and a number of other artists. So it was a very important curatorship, if I can say that.
Now, since Truman Lowe's passing, you've been involved in making sure that even more people get to be exposed with his art. You work with his family to make sure that some of his works, that more of his works are added to museums' collections. Talk about that process. How do you introduce yourself to these museums and explain to them the opportunity that they have to bring these works into their collection?
Well, to be completely honest, it's kind of an easy sell because his reputation as an artist precedes him. He did not sell many works during his lifetime. He was more interested in making art, and he didn't. He had a livelihood at the university, so he didn't have to make money from his art. So he wasn't really particularly interested in selling works to museums during his lifetime, although he did, let me be clear. The Denver Art Museum has a beautiful, absolutely exquisite waterfall that he made, again, out of wood. But since his passing, and particularly in the climate we're in right now, museums are finally understanding that they need to represent the broad diversity of artists. So not just white male artists, but really to look at women artists, artists of color, and Truman's art, because it is, because it has a very unique but universal kind of aesthetic and appeal, he's being very well received, I should say, by museums. So for example, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago has bought a couple pieces. The Metropolitan Museum in New York has bought pieces, or one piece, I should say. The Smithsonian American Art Museum, as well as the National Museum of the American Indian, have also bought a number of works. So his work is going to Boston Museum of Fine Arts, St. Louis Art Museum. Museums of national reputation are really sort of finally understanding that his work is important and needs to be preserved and collected.
In looking at his work, as you have throughout his career, but especially now in terms of his now being part of history, do you notice common threads? Are there themes in his art, or are there things that he was trying to communicate through his art?
Yes, very much so. I would say his native heritage was one, and then respect and reverence for the natural environment, the natural world, were his two primary concerns. A lot of his sculptures and drawings are about water, moving water streams, that's freshwater streams. And that was a subject that he returned to over and over again. And in fact, in the Metropolitan Museum in New York right now, one of his signature pieces, it's called Feather Canoe, is included in an exhibit, a very timely exhibit about water, the politics and also the aesthetics of water. So that's really, I mean, his work is very timely, very contemporary. It's modern and American as much as it is Native American.
Our time is unfortunately coming nearly to a close, but I want to ask you about his legacy. How is there a way to sum up the legacy of someone like Truman Lowe, who is, as you talked about, multifaceted and very deep in in the reflective nature of his work?
Well, that is a hard question, and that's why I think I've been struggling with my remarks for Monday's ceremony. I think his primary legacy is as a Native American contemporary artist. He really helped to broaden our perceptions of contemporary Native American art, both in his art and then also as a curator, and even in his teaching, when he supported and nurtured those Native American artists, young students, he was really thinking about the future of contemporary Native American art, of Native American art in general. So I think his legacy is sort of a combination of his artwork about Native American heritage and the woodland environment, and then also his teaching and his curating, in a similar vein.
At 1 o'clock on Monday, as you've mentioned, you're participating in a dedication ceremony at the Truman T. Lowe Center for the Arts on the campus of UW-La Crosse. What do you think he would have thought about all that?
Oh, you know, he, as you said earlier, he was so unassuming and so modest, and yet he was comfortable in his own skin. I think, though, that he would be thinking more about the importance of this naming of a building in honor of a Native American, a Ho-Chunk, a Wisconsin artist. He would see that in terms of landmarks for Native America generally. So, in other words, I think he would be very happy to see that UW-La Crosse is really sort of thinking about being more inclusive and honoring these various traditions.
If my memory is right, and I heard the chancellor talk about this last year when he first announced the idea, I think this is the first. I know it's the first building on campus named for a Native American, I believe, and I think it's the first building on campus named for someone who's not white. How important would that have been to Truman Lowe?
I think that would have been very important. I mean, as I say, it marks a defining moment in the history of Native America. I think there's actually only one other building in the United States that is named after a contemporary or recent Native American. So it's really a huge honor, I have to say. And I know he would be so pleased and proud, both of his alma mater and of his own, what's the word I'm looking for? His own accomplishments.
Dr. Jo Otell is the Nystrom Professor Emerita of Art History at Beloit College. She's the author of Woodland Reflections, The Art of Truman Lowe, and we've been talking about Truman Lowe here today on Newsmakers. Jo Otell, thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to reach out to the show, you can always send me an email, newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. As I mentioned, we're covering the 91st Assembly next on Newsmakers. We'll hear from the Democratic candidate in that race, Maria Bamonte. She's running against the Republican incumbent, Treg Pryczynski, and we'll cover that race next here on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. from Wisconsin Public Radio. This is election coverage. I'm Ezra Wall, and we're focusing on the 92nd Assembly District in this conversation. The incumbent in that race is Republican Treg Pranchinsky, and the challenger in that race is Democrat Maria Bamonte. And the 92nd Assembly encompasses all of Buffalo and Trempealeau counties, and then parts of Jackson, Eau Claire, and Pepin counties. And Maria Bamonte joins me now. Maria, thanks a lot for joining us on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself to our listeners. Tell us a little bit about who you are and why you're running there in the 92nd.
I'm Maria Bamonte, and I live in Gilmanton, Wisconsin. I own a business in Mondovi, so I'm a small business owner. We are farmers, and I actually, am a founding member and board president of Anthony Akers Charter School, and which is part of the Mondovi Public School District. That's my favorite group to be part of because it shows what can be accomplished when people work together for a common goal. I grew up in the suburbs of Minneapolis and chose to live here in Gilmanton and raise my daughter. I have been here for about 12 years, and I just fell in love with the community here. They're the most hardworking, amazing, kind, generous people. I was presented with the opportunity. I was actually asked to run for assembly, and at first I said, absolutely not. But then after having a conversation with some of my neighbors and some careful consideration, I realized that's an opportunity to fight for my neighbors and to be their voice in Madison.
Well, speaking of your status as a business owner, this will not come as a surprise to you, but a lot of people are concerned with the direction the economy could be headed in the near future and longer term. Businesses especially are facing workforce challenges, trying to find people to fill open jobs. And I'm wondering what lawmakers can do on a state level. What do you hope to do as a legislator to mitigate that problem?
Yeah, I can definitely speak to that. We opened our business the year before the pandemic hit, and we're a hospitality business. So we dealt with supply chain issues. We dealt with staff shortages, all of the things that all other small businesses are dealing with. And they're so important to our economy. I think some of the things that can be done on a political level are grants supporting small businesses, especially what's happening right now. I believe there are Main Street grants. I know that as far as staff shortages, a lot of our staff and people in our community were looking for childcare. They didn't have childcare. So if we could help find ways to support childcare or make it more affordable in those ways, just to help people find ways to get back to work.
On the personal economy side of it, a lot of people who are not business owners, nevertheless, they feel economic pressure due to inflation right now, and inflation continues to be a top of mind issue for working families. What steps can legislators take to address inflation? I know our national leaders are focusing a lot on the issue on both sides of the aisle in different ways, but what can state legislators do?
Yeah, that's a great question. I wish I had a really great answer for you for that. It's such a broad question. I think what we can do is help with, I know that right now we have a tax surplus in our economy, and Governor Evers is looking at possibly some tax cuts so that can get money back in the pockets of our people in our community.
Another issue facing state legislators across the country now that has been really not as much of a state issue in the last 50 or so years is abortion. Wisconsin's law is 172 years old, and it's now in effect again after the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. What are your feelings about how the legislature should address the abortion issue, or if they even should address the abortion issue in light of Wisconsin's law being so old?
Yeah, we definitely need to make sure that abortions are fair or are legal and safe in our community. I don't think that the government should be involved with a personal decision that should be between a family, a woman, and her doctor. I think that government should not be involved in that decision.
We're talking with Maria Bomonti. She's the Democratic candidate in the 92nd Assembly. She faces the incumbent, who is Republican Treg Princhinsky. The 92nd encompasses all of Buffalo and Trempealeau counties and parts of Jackson, Eau Claire, and Pepin counties in western Wisconsin. On to the topic of elections, Maria. Despite multiple government audits showing no evidence of fraud in the 2020 election, you've still got Wisconsin voters, some of them, who have concerns about election integrity, and some people who are running for office are making it a big issue. How would you address the concerns that those voters have, even in light of the lack of evidence for those concerns?
Yeah, that's another big issue. I actually worked as a poll worker for a few years, and I can attest to how much work goes into making sure that those elections are safe and fair. There are so many safety precautions put into place for each and every district. I think probably some more transparency and understanding of how the election process goes would be really beneficial. Some education would go a long ways. I think I didn't know very much about it before I was involved. And now that I have been involved, I don't know that there is a way for it not to be accurate.
On education, you talked about being involved in the group that runs your local charter school. On the issue of education, obviously, it's a big expenditure for the state, and it's something that a lot of people care about who have children or grandchildren in the system, and it's an issue for taxpayers as well. So what would your priority be as a state legislator in terms of education?
Well, I know working with the schools that we need more money. We need more funding for both programs and for our educators, for transportation. There's a lot that goes into it. For instance, the Mondovi School District, because of the federal funds that were given because of COVID, was able to add an extra class that helped the kids that had fallen behind over COVID. And they're concerned that be able to continue that class. And it has been such a great success helping students graduate. So if we could find ways to fund even more programs like that. We need more mental health programs. Our educators work so incredibly hard, and they're more than just teachers to the kids. So we need to make sure that they're getting treated fairly.
Speaking of those educators, what can be done to attract a qualified teacher force in Wisconsin? Some people talk about teacher pay, and then some people look at the workload that they face and say, you know what, it's not all about the money.
Yeah, it, you know, I've seen a lot of burnout over the last few years, and it's not just with teachers, but it's especially with teachers, because as we have all seen, since we were able to jump into our kids' classrooms when they were virtual, the teachers are, they're caretakers. They're so much more than teachers. So what can we do to help them? We need to have really supportive communities, I think. And I think it comes back to involvement. More parents involved and more parent support too could help in so many ways. We just all need to be participating at every level.
Participating in every level, and we have seen some of that with more parents showing up to school board meetings as they get concerned about one issue or another. How much authority should parents have, involvement notwithstanding? How much actual, like, day-to-day, I want you to teach my kids this paragraph and not that paragraph, should they have over what curriculum is taught in schools?
Yeah, I kind of realized where I stopped, because I realized I was going in that direction. I think that we elect our boards, that their role is for policy and governance. And then they are responsible for hiring the teachers to do that job. So if we're making sure that process works well, then we're involved in either participating on the board of directors or really being involved in those elections to make sure that we're electing board of directors for our schools that represent who we are, and trusting that they're making the right decisions and hiring the educators that are going to make the right choices for our children.
So what role should parents play when they have concerns about what their children are learning? We heard a lot of talk recently about social issues, like how schools deal with race or sexuality or those kinds of things. Where does parental involvement in the instruction on those issues start or end?
Well, there are kids, and it's a public school, so I definitely believe we should know and understand what is being taught in our schools. I know, for instance, Mondovi School District, they're super transparent about what is being taught. They send out curriculum and information on the curriculum, and that is a good way for the school to share with the parents. And then they open up a conversation. For instance, our superintendent says, if you have questions or concerns, please talk to me there. And I think that is a really great way to start with it. And because most educators and most administrative people in, most of the administration is willing to have that conversation, and usually a conversation can find a lot of solutions.
Also related to schools, but not exclusively related to schools, are concerns about public safety. We've seen shootings of different kinds in schools and other areas and other public disturbances. The parade in Waukesha comes to mind a while back. How do we keep schools and communities safe in the wake of all these different deadly events?
Yeah, it's scary times indeed. I think that is a multi-layered question. I wish it could come back to something as simple as all of us taking care of one another, so it never got to that point. The AR-15s are a big question. I know we're in the state of Wisconsin where gun rights, everybody, I come from a hunting family. We want to protect our rights, our gun rights, but we have to make sure that we're also protecting our children when we're sending them to school every day. So I believe that data shows that simple things such as increasing the age limit to purchase an AR-15 can be a big help. I know there's a lot of talk about, I'm drawing a blank on what it's called, but is it the cash? The bailout plan, I know there's a lot of talk. That's not the right word for it, but give me one second to get my thoughts together.
Are you talking about like a gun buyback plan?
Not the gun buyback plan. Okay. I'm talking about bail reform. I just kind of switched gears on you, but because you had mentioned the parade and the gentleman was released. So I know there's a lot of people working to find solutions to make our community safer.
In terms of if you were elected, you would be a Democrat going into what has been recently a fairly Republican environment. Where do you see opportunities for bipartisan cooperation? How can the legislature improve communication and working across party lines?
I think we have to. I don't think there's any other way to find solutions. Definitely a red area, and we have not been represented by a woman yet either, so that would be a great voice to have at the table. If I was elected, which any elected official should do, is understand that we're not only representing the Democratic Party, we would be representing everyone in our community. So I think that is really important as a leader to understand all sides of every issue and then make the best decision for everyone in that community.
You talked about being a farmer. The environment is a big concern for a lot of people. People are talking about PFAS and other chemicals in drinking water. In rural parts of our state, people are concerned with large feeding operations, commercial feeding operations that could have an impact on water quality. What should the legislature be doing to look out for environmental concerns?
Absolutely everything. Everything that we possibly can. The environment is 100% at the top of my list for protecting. I know where we live, our wells have been contaminated by nitrates in the waters. Eau Claire has PFAS everywhere. So if we don't have clean water, we're seeing in a lot of communities in our country what happens if we don't have clean water. So working with farmers, I know there's farmers that are already doing wonderful things in regenerative farming, and there are farmers that want to do more things, but we can't pass like the financial burden on them to switch over, and we can't add more workload to them. So we have to find solutions that benefit both the farmer and the land. So I think there are so many great things already happening, and I would definitely love to expand upon those.
As we close our conversation, I want to give you an opportunity to articulate. You talked about kind of why you're running for office. Now I want to ask you regarding your opponent in this race, the Republican incumbent Treg Pranchinsky, who's the current assembly representative in the 92nd district. Maria Bamonte, what sets you apart from Treg, and why should people consider your candidacy?
Well, I don't like comparing myself to other people, but I will tell you that I am a really hard worker. I will show up and be your voice. I'm dedicated to making sure that this community is the best that it possibly can be. And I think the one thing that I definitely will bring is that I'm willing to listen and make sure that I'm not necessarily just pushing my personal agenda, but I'm making sure that all of our voices are heard and we're finding solutions that work for all of us.
Maria Bamonte, a candidate for state assembly. She's the Democrat running in the 92nd Assembly District on Tuesday, November the 8th. Maria, thanks a lot for being here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you so much.
Maria Bamonte is the Democratic candidate running in the 91st Assembly District, which encompasses all of Buffalo and Trempealeau counties, and then parts of Jackson, Eau Claire, and Pepin counties in western Wisconsin. Bamonte is running against the incumbent, Republican Treg Pranchinsky. Of course, as always, we give every ballot-qualified candidate the opportunity to come and do an interview with us. We send out invitations via email and via telephone, and Mr. Pranchinsky's campaign did not opt to schedule a time with us. If you're interested in hearing this conversation again or anything else that we had on the show today, we talked about Truman Lowe, the artist and sculptor, earlier in the program today. You can find all our programs at our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. That's wpr.org/newsmakers. And another thing you can do at our website is to become a member of WPR. You've probably heard by now that it's our fall member drive here on WPR, and we're asking all of our listeners to be not only listeners, but take an active role in their listenership by becoming members of WPR. You can do that by going to wpr.org or 888-202-2552. Any gift of any amount is the correct gift. Listener support is the biggest source of funding for us here at WPR, so we really count on you day in and day out. Thank you very much if you've already given. If you haven't, now is the time at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And if you're there thinking, I've never given to public radio before, I don't want to make a commitment that's too big, well, today's the perfect day for you. If you want to become a new member, or even if you've already given before and you want to become a sustainer for the first time, today is $5 Friday. So you ask for that WPR tote bag when you give $5 a month today. Support the programs that you value and show your love for Wisconsin and, of course, your favorite Wisconsin radio station. The offer is only available today, so make sure you give now. $5 a month at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. You know you rely on programs like Newsmakers here on the Ideas Network for timely information. In-depth discussions really is what we specialize on Newsmakers, not sound bites like you might hear at some other outlets or even in some of our newscasts. But if you appreciate the long discussions, the deep, in-depth information that you're finding on our program, we'd love for you to support us. The Ideas Network is important to your life. We're listener-supported. Your gift makes the Ideas Network possible. So give today. Your gift in any amount really makes a big difference. Member drives are such an important time to hear from new members. If you've never given before, make today the day you become a member. Give $5 a month or more on $5 Friday, and make sure you ask for that WPR tote bag when you give. Go to WPR.org or phone 888-202-2552. And then remember to tune in next week for another Newsmakers, right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.